I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Jim Kelly is a Hall of Fame quarterback known for being a fierce competitor, for being, quote, Kelly tough. His toughness was tested when his son Hunter was diagnosed with leukodystrophy, a rare genetic disorder that affects the nervous system. His form is called Krabbe disease. Hunter died when he was 8 years old, more than a decade ago. His parents founded Hunter's Hope to raise awareness about this disease and to advocate for newborn screening. Pennsylvania will be screening for this and other rare disease, joining a few other states. Kelly will be in Philadelphia on Friday when Children's Hospital opens its new Leukodystrophy Center for Excellence, and he joins us on Radio Times. Jim Kelly, a great pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin with you, because I know that you were diagnosed with cancer about a year ago. I just want to know, and I'm sure our listeners want to know, how you are feeling.
I'm doing pretty good. As a matter of fact, I just had my quarterly MRI about 3 weeks ago, and so far so good. Thank you, good Lord, that I'm cancer-free right now. And as people out there know, when you have cancer, you got to do your quarterly, and then if it's all good, then you do, you know, every 6 months. And I hopefully 15 years from now, I'll be having to do it every 4 to 5 years.
Well, we
feel pretty good. Thanks for asking.
Well, you're very welcome, and we hope that for you as well. Jim, tell us a little bit about your son, Hunter.
Well, he was born on my birthday, Valentine's Day, and he's pretty much a son that I've always dreamt about. And I mean, any father out there listening knows, you know, having a son is what you wish for and you pray for. For me, it was on my birthday, so I already had the game plan was already done. The script was written. Everything was all ready. You know, he was going to be a quarterback and go fishing and hunting and camping and all the great things that I dreamt about doing with my son. But to be honest with you, he's my little hero. I saw what he battled through week in and week out, year after year. And that's, you know, even though I was brought up in a family of six boys and we were taught by our father to be tough and never show weakness, my son every day battled. And I admired the fight that he had in him. And that's probably how I continued to have my fight through my cancer, is known I saw what Hunter went through. And if he can go through it the way he did, I know I can do it. So he is and was my hero, and a little boy that has made me the man I am today and made me a stronger individual.
Well, that's, I mean, frankly, very inspiring to hear that. Help us understand, first of all, Krabbe disease and how young was he when he was first diagnosed?
Well, you know, at the beginning, you were talking about advocating for newborn screening. Well, when my son was born, you know, he passed all the screen tests. And at this time, New York was only testing for 11 diseases. When you had states like Mississippi 45, Illinois 51, New Jersey, I think it was like a 14 or something like that. Every state was different on how many diseases they test for. But I really didn't think about it, to be honest with you, because I had five brothers and I have nieces and nephews, and My wife's mother came from a family of 10, and everybody was healthy. So I really didn't even think about it or even know much about it. And I mean, I knew that they did the heel prick and all that, but really didn't focus on it. And so the thing about Hunter and his you know, stuff he went through, we took him home, thought he was completely healthy, and he wasn't reaching his milestone. So, of course, we changed his formula. We thought he had colic and all these things that the doctors continued to tell us and our pediatrician. And then he said he was showing signs of cerebral palsy. And for a family and for a parent to hear those are devastating. And then to find out 4 months into his life he had leukodystrophy and that there was nothing we could do, is too late. If he was diagnosed at birth, we would have been able to get a cord blood transplant. We've been able to try to do something, but by the time he was diagnosed, it was too late. And that's the key of what we're doing with our foundation, Hunter's Hope, is trying to get kids tested at birth to give them a chance, because early detection for any disease is so crucial, so vital, because these kids, once the disease has already kicked in, it's too late. You cannot reverse it. So what we're focusing on right now is to make a difference for kids, making sure that they have a chance to dream like I was able to, you know, dream. And I hope people don't take this wrong, but You know, I know we have to send billions and billions and billions of dollars overseas to different countries. I understand that. I get it. But we need to save some of that money for our own kids right here in the United States of America. When we found out, my wife and I found out, that thousands of babies are dying every year in our country because they were born in a state that didn't test for that particular disease. And if they were in a state that tested for that particular disease, they would have had a chance at a quality of life. And when I know we've sent so much money everywhere else, and we could save our own children right here in our own country to give them a chance to dream like I was able to do as a little boy, we need to have something changed. I don't know who is going to be the president of the United States the next term, but I guarantee you one guy's going to be knocking at the door. It's the guy that's talking on the phone right now. I want to make sure that they get what we're talking about. They change legislation. Pennsylvania has been a very good state of doing things to change, to make things better. So has New York, but there's so many states are behind the eight ball. We got to get this changed. We got to give our own kids a chance.
It's great to hear that kind of passion and that kind of advocacy. And we have another parent who's going to be joining us after we say goodbye to you, Jim Kelly. But this is a more personal question, even a parent-to-parent question. I mean, as a parent, the thought of losing a child, it just seems kind of overwhelming and devastating. This is something that you and your wife had to deal with. Hunter lived until he was 8, and I know that was really beyond expectation. But I just want to know how you live with a child and with the reality, knowing that this child probably won't live a full life.
It's not easy. At the beginning, I was mad. You know, I was mad at God. I was mad at everybody that came up to me and said, you know what, you're a chosen father to have a little boy named Hunter to change other people's lives. I didn't want to hear that. I wanted a healthy child. And it didn't take me very long to realize that my wife was right, again, saying that we need to do something about it. We can make a difference, and we have. But I'll tell you what, it's not easy for all those parents out there that have a child with a disability. They understand what I'm talking about. You know, it not only is stressful on the mother, but it's stressful on your marriage. You have to be able to pull together as a family. And it was hard for us, you know, through the years that Hunter was here. I'm not gonna lie to you. I mean, our marriage really strayed, and it was tough, but you know, we kept our faith, and thank the good Lord that we hung in there, we hung together, and Daddy finally gets it. It took me a while, but you know, I know it's God's perfect timing on getting what you need to do in order to make your life better and make your kids' life better, and that's exactly how we had to deal with it. And I know where I'm at now, and I do understand that through my son's suffering, we will make a difference. And I know for some people that's hard to swallow, but you either do that or you feel sorry for yourself, crawl in a little corner in the side and don't do anything about it. But I know through my son Hunter, we can and we will and we have made a difference for other kids. And you know, that's the way I look at life now, that every day you don't know what tomorrow holds. And I know that's an old cliche, but it is what it is. It's something that you have to deal with. And how can I make it better for other families, other kids? I know it's not going to help my son, and it did not help my son, but it's going to help others down the road.
You mentioned, you know, watching your child suffering. And as I said, we have another parent who will be talking from her perspective after the break. But again, as a parent, you know, you don't want your child to suffer. How do you be a parent and watch that, knowing there are probably some things you can do, but there are so many things you can't do?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't matter that I was a professional football player. My wife talks about this all the time, that my name was Jim Kelly. I'm in the Hall of Fame, all these great things that came to me prior to, but there's nothing you can do. We did a lot of praying. We trusted the good Lord that, you know, that there's reasons for his suffering and that. But you have to keep that attitude. You got to be able to make a difference. And for us, it was making a difference today for someone who is fighting for tomorrow. And that's our phrase that we use, because I know even when I was in the hospital, that was something that I was blessed because I had a family that came in with an attitude that they're going to make my day better by how they presented themselves, how they walked into my room. And for all those people out there that have children that are suffering or parents or whatever the case may be, make their day better by how you are around them. Don't go in there with a frown on your face. Go in with an attitude that you're going to put a smile on their face, even though they might be suffering, even though they might be hurting. Make sure you make their day better by your presence in that room. Make their day better by how you act around them. And who knows what my I do know now, but what my wife, my daughter, my brothers did after they left my room and when they would leave Hunter site. But the thing is, while you're around the sick, while you're around people that are suffering, don't go in there with an attitude that you're going to feel sorry for. Go in there with an attitude that you're going to make their day better. And that's how you have to do. You have to keep a positive attitude and making your day better.
How was this? What was the effect of Hunter's illness on your children?
Well, it made my daughter stronger. As a matter of fact, my daughter Erin, who is my oldest, who just turned 20 and she's going to Liberty University, just wrote a book called Kelly Tough. Huh? And she journaled how when she was being brought up, how she had to see what her little brother was going through and how he passed away when she was 10 years old and how she had to stay strong for him and how I brought her up to be Kelly Tough, how I brought her up to, you know, if you fall down, you got to bounce back up. You have to keep that positive attitude through all things. And then how she had to battle through, okay, she lost her brother. Now she's going to lose her dad through cancer. And how she had to stay strong for her father, how she had to stay strong for her mother and her sister, and how she battled through that. So there's things that, you know, kids, you can and cannot tell them. And but my daughter, we pretty much were open as we could be. Cameron, our youngest, who is 15 now, didn't really experience a lot of that because she was really young at the time. But she saw what Hunter went through. But more importantly right now is my oldest daughter, how she journaled and how she continued to pray and keep her faith and stay strong through the battles of the two men in her life, and that was her father and her little brother, and how she drew strength from my wife, Jill, and how she never gave up and how she wanted to make their days better by just that big smile that she always had on her face.
We're almost out of time here. You were known when you were, you know, pretty fierce quarterback. You're a Hall of Fame quarterback for being Kelly Tough. Do you have a different definition today of what it is to be Kelly Tough?
Yeah, it's overrated.
It's overrated.
Oh, my goodness. You know what? I was brought up in a family of six boys, and we were taught to be tough. I mean, you get knocked down, you get back up. You never showed weakness. And how I taught my daughters and to tell you the truth, you know what, it's staying strong. It's having surrounding yourself with people that continue to inspire you. People in the last year have talked to me and told me, have written me letters and prayer cards to tell me what an inspiration I've been to them. But I want people to understand how much an inspiration they've been to me to make me continue to fight, because my fight was making other people fight. And the phrase that I came up with when I was laying in my hotel room about a month and a half ago, somewhere around there, that when people told me all these things and how that inspired me to keep fighting, but make a difference today for someone who is fighting for tomorrow. If you really think about that phrase, make a difference today for someone who is fighting tomorrow.
Jim
it
Kelly,
makes so much sense.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, and good luck to you as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Sure. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Maria Kafalis and her husband, Patrick Carr, are sociologists and have been guests on Radio Times a number of times to talk about their groundbreaking work on families. Their daughter, Calliope Joy, was diagnosed with a rare form of leukodystrophy a few years ago. Her future is uncertain. Her parents started the Calliope Joy Foundation to raise money and awareness about leukodystrophies and to give funds to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia for treatment and care, and to do other work as well. Maria Kafalis, a professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University, she's writing a memoir about her daughter, Cal, called Excruciating Joy. Maria Kafalis, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure, Marty.
It's a great pleasure to have. And I should say to our listeners that the last time I think Maria was on, you literally were about to give birth to Calliope Joy. I mean, within moments.
Within moments. You were prepared to deliver.
We were ready to deliver this child for her. I'm glad we didn't actually have to do that. Let me introduce our other guest. Amy Waldman is a pediatric neurologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. That's CHOP. She's an assistant professor of neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, medical director of CHOP's Leukodystrophy Center for Excellence. It's a newly formed program dedicated to the diagnosis and treatment of these rare diseases. And Amy Waldman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
And to our listeners, I do want to open up the lines and also give a chance for people to weigh in after my conversation with Jim Kelly. But Maria, I do want to talk about your daughter, Calliope Joy. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So Calliope is about 5 years old.
She's five now.
And she was diagnosed with a form, I guess, of leukodystrophy.
There are more than 40 kinds of leukodystrophy, and some are unspecified, so the doctors are still trying to figure out the genetic causes. Cal was diagnosed very typically at about age two. She was nicknamed Happy Feet at church because she was always running and always in motion. And about a couple weeks before she was diagnosed, we noticed she was losing her balance. And we knew something was a little bit off. We thought maybe because she was the youngest child, because her nanny was from Brazil and she wasn't hearing a lot of English. But she was
her speech seemed a little delayed.
She had fewer words than we might have thought. But she was so active, and she was eating meatballs. I'll never forget this, eating meatballs at 5 months. And so she seemed very, very healthy, which is very typical of these children. At about 28 months, we started to see these balance issues. And at first, we thought she'd had ear infections. And so we brought her to a fabulous specialist at CHOP. And I'll never forget, he never really looked away from his computer. He said, if I were you, I would take your daughter right away to see a neurologist.
Really?
And yes, he said it's not her ears. And the next day, we were at CHOP. And her regular pediatrician said it was a Saturday. She said, just bring her into the ED. And it was...
What's the ED?
The emergency room at CHOP.
Okay.
And you could tell.
Something was wrong,
really,
seriously wrong.
Really wrong. The neurologists were hovering around her, and 3 days later we got this diagnosis, which, believe it or not, is a blessing in the leukodystrophy community. CHOP is so phenomenal. These diseases are quite rare and very hard to diagnose. So most families spend months, if not years, going back and forth. So we were very blessed to find out that news so quickly. And then a couple days later, we had the other great blessing of meeting Dr. Waldman, who started to work with us, and she was as well. This is a nightmare, but if you're going to be in a nightmare, this is the woman you want with you.
It's good to have someone reliable during a
absolutely,
nightmare.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something, though, that Jim Kelly referenced, which is, and all parents do this, you have a child, you have fantasies about what their life is going to be like, what it's going to be like for them to grow
yes.
up, to move out of the house, to have their own life.
Yes.
When you have a child with the kind of disability that your child has, you don't have those same kinds of fantasies.
You know, I always tell newly diagnosed families, I have a couple of rules. And one of the rules is I don't go back to what I thought my life was going to be. That is, I have amnesia about that old life. In fact, I can count, there are five pictures of Cal as she was. We really stay completely focused on every day with her. We are so grateful for every day with her. We don't compare her to how she used to be because it would make us all crazy. And I had a very good friend who's a Catholic priest who works at St. Chris's, and he gave me the best advice, which was, if you have the courage to be around children like Hunter or Cal, they will reveal to you the meaning of life. They will teach you how to live in a way. And I think Jim Kelly really referenced that you think you have it all figured out,
right.
And then you meet these children, and
right.
boy, they teach you a lot. And the extraordinary thing about Dr. Waldman is that she had chosen to be with these children. And I think that the doctors who often work with these kids are so extraordinary because they figured it out pretty early on, too.
I do want to get to Amy Waldman. I have another question for you, Maria. I feel a little awkward asking this, but should we feel sorry for you and your husband?
No. People ask me all the time, do I regret Cal? Could I have, if I could have gone back and not had this baby? I mean, I hate this disease. It is a disease that makes you, you know, it is a disease so horrible you couldn't have imagined it in your worst nightmares. At the same time, Cal is so beautiful and so perfect. And I call the sort of my memoir Excruciating Joy, because for the first couple months after Cal was diagnosed, all I did was hold my baby and think to myself, how could I have been so blind to the perfection of my life? And that's the cruelty of it, that you don't know how great your life is until something like that happens. So suffering, as horrible as it is, it reveals to you what is important, and you don't see that. Mm. So as you know, I was writing books and I was doing my thing and I was, on the Marty Mosgreen show and on the lecture circuit. And
it's a boy, different life now.
That doesn't matter nearly so much.
Oh, that's
you know, and really, you just look at the world so differently. And that's been a blessing. But I wish Cal didn't have to be sick for me to figure it out.
Let me turn to you, Amy Waldman. I think for our listeners, and I had to do a very rough and quick kind of understanding of what leukodystrophy is or are, because there are a number of forms of it. But let's do the medical portion. What are we talking about here? What is this?
Absolutely. Well, just like heart disease can mean very different things, leukodystrophy means a white matter problem in the brain. And many of the traditional leukodystrophies, of which there are over 30, affect the white matter of the brain, but there are also about 60 to 70 other diseases that have a similar effect also on the white matter. So we're talking about over 100 different diseases that all affect the connections in the brain, how the brain processes information, and how it sends information. So that's why these children develop challenges with their either development or developmental regression, and they lose skills, the ability to talk, walk, eat on their own, all the things that we take for granted.
Is it a fatal disease?
They
is
are.
It is. I mean, yeah. Hunter lived till 8.
Yep. They present at different ages. Even within, for example, Krabbe, there's an early onset form and an infantile form. There's a later onset form. So it always depends on what type it is. It's hard to actually predict that sometimes. There's genetic testing that allows us to make the diagnosis, but the genetic testing doesn't always tell you what the life expectancy is or what the type or the presentation. So they present at different ages, which makes it challenging as well. But all of them are ultimately fatal because we don't currently have cures.
What is the treatment? I mean, if a child has a diagnosis, for instance, like Calliope Joy.
For many of the children right now, there are no treatments. There are some experimental therapies that are out there in the world. One type of experimental therapy is enzyme replacement therapy, where they're trying to get enough enzyme into the brain to try to help the brain function. The problem is that if you give that into the blood, the enzyme doesn't travel to the brain to fix the damage. So there are other methods people are working on to try to get that enzyme into the brain. There's also stem cell transplants or cord blood transplants. Some people are trying those therapies to see if new cells can bring the brain the energy and the fuel that it needs to fix the problem. The challenge there is it takes about a year to a year and a half to get enough of the new cells to the brain to fix the disease. Mm. And as you can imagine, if we gave Jim Kelly a cancer drug but said it's not going to work for a year and a half, he would say, this is crazy.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to take a drug that's not going to work right away. But that's what's happening with the transplants. So we need to figure out how to do safer, more effective transplants. And there's some hope with gene therapy in combination with transplant.
And we're talking about these are genetic diseases or genetic disorders?
Yes, we believe that these are all genetic diseases. We don't have the gene identified for some of them. For Krabbe, we do. For metachromatic leukodystrophy, adrenal leukodystrophy, many of those disorders, we have identified the gene.
Right.
But there are a slew of them that we can identify based on an abnormal MRI and clinical symptoms, but we haven't recognized the gene yet.
And your daughter has
metachromatic leukodystrophy.
Right, right. Yeah. So what is her day like?
Cal gets up. Cal runs our house, basically. And Cal gets up every morning and she demands that people come to her. And
how does she do that?
She starts yelling. And she's nonverbal. Most the kids are. But all her nurses really marvel at the fact that she has a great way of communicating. So we call it Cali song. When she's in a good mood, she has this kind of almost like a purr. And she sings and she coos to you. And she's just so happy to see you. And she just smiles with this incredible smile. And if she's annoyed, she lets you know. And so she gets up in the morning. She relies on a G-tube. We get her ready.
That's a gastric tube.
Gastric tube.
To feed her.
Yes. And, yeah, they lose the ability to eat fairly quickly. And then her nurse arrives at 8 a.m. Her nurse, we call it her spa treatment in the morning. She is fussed about for an hour, gets her outfits on, gets her cream on, gets a checkup every morning. And on days like today, she's out for a walk. She's fed. The feeds take a long time, unfortunately, and she can't tolerate feeds a lot of the time. The kids really struggle to, even with the feeding tube, it takes 4 or 5 hours for her to eat. So a lot of her day is really just getting her,
getting her nutrition.
But we sing and we play. Her brother and sister are so amazing. Jim talked about this.
Yes. The fact that these children are,
when you first start turning your house into a hospital, it's very frightening and your children notice it. And my children were not happy to have their house be overrun with nurses and doctors and hospice staff and boxes of medicine and a hospital bed. The day that her bed was replaced with a hospital bed was a really bad day.
And she's the youngest of three.
She's the youngest of three. But then again, my children are just so amazing around kids. They instinctively know how to deal with a kid with a feeding tube or a vent, and they don't turn away. You know, when they see kids, they don't turn away. They know exactly how to engage with them. And so many of the siblings go into medicine and work with young children, and they're just so, their compassion, people have documented this as a sociologist, and it's fascinating. Their compassion and empathy is off the charts. And I am so proud of my kids, but it's a really high price to pay for amazing kids. But I do have some amazing kids.
Did you have to sort of figure out how with all that Cal needed, sort of how to balance that to make sure that your other two children had their life as well? Because it seems like she requires a lot of attention.
I think early on, my husband and I kind of almost apologized to the kids for the fact that things were not going to be the way that they were supposed to be. And the greatest gift we had in terms of really supporting them through that was the extraordinary teachers and the CHOP folks in palliative care who do child life support and are really, really skilled at. There's a real pattern to this whole process. It's not like you're reinventing the wheel every single time it happens. So they've seen this before. They know what kids need. My son and my daughter, I think, were so helped by their teachers who actually helped my son write a book about Cal's disease, which is now sold at our school as a fundraiser. And it's become a really useful tool to explain the disease to other children, but also for my son to process it, because he couldn't say things to us, but he explained it to his classmates. And they created this beautiful book about this family with a little girl who's actually a cupcake, Cal the cupcake, and this cupcake family that tries to raise money for a cure. And they talked about neurologic diseases. And you see these little third graders spelling out neurological with great care and asking impossibly difficult questions that their parents couldn't ask. And so the kids were able to process it in ways that were actually more, I think, complex than their parents could.
But you have been very public about,
yes,
Cal, what's been going on in your family. Was that something you knew you needed this for the family, or?
Well, my daughter would say, my daughter who's now 15 would say she really struggled with it. She didn't want to learn her sister's disease for about a year, and that she's now really likes the public fundraising and doing something positive. Just like Jim Kelly said. I mean, yeah. I think it's, you have two choices. You can really, and no one would blame you, you can crawl up into your bed and never get out again. And then the other way out is to figure out a way to help other families. And I think almost the first day I met Dr. Waldman, that incredible day, I said to her, I know you're not going to save Cal, but I want to be a part of helping other children. And I think that was something my husband and I both wanted to do and recognize. And then our children joined that that, and then our community did. And one of the first people I talked to, I got to give a shout out to, is Liz Scott in Alex's Lemonade, who basically taught us how to do this. And I had just been at an Alex's Lemonade stand that about 2 weeks before Cal was diagnosed. And I thought to myself, how can Liz do this? And here we are.
And here you are. Exactly. Now, Pennsylvania will be starting to screen for some of these rare diseases. How many states are doing this? And is this part of a trend looking at some of these rare diseases? My understanding is that to qualify for a rare disease, it's something like 200,000 people or less. But then I read something like 10% of the U.S. population has some kind of rare disease. So there are clearly lots of rare diseases.
Yes, there are probably about 7,000 different rare diseases that meet that criteria. Pennsylvania, starting with just a few, starting about six diseases. Really, Krabbe is the only true leukodystrophy. Some of those others are considered the leukoencephalopathies. And because of Hanna's Law, it's been passed now in Pennsylvania.
And this is another child that had...
Another child that had Krabbe, and Emma's Law in New Jersey. And I think really... what this is about is the legacy of Hunter and Emma and Hannah. These are the only three states currently approved to test for Krabbe. Pennsylvania and New Jersey hopefully will start screening later in the year. There are some other states that are looking into newborn screening for these disorders. California is looking into adrenal leukodystrophy, another type of leukodystrophy. In the Midwest, they're looking into maybe passing again for Krabbe. But it's only three states now that have actually been
actually,
approved.
Actually, I think it's seven for Krabbe.
Have been approved?
Yes.
I think New York's the only one that's currently testing.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, yes.
And how do you test for it? I mean, is it a blood test? Prick in the heel?
As Jim mentioned, all babies get this heel prick before they leave the hospital. And many parents don't even realize that it's happening and don't even know much about their state newborn screening. Coming from Pennsylvania, having three kids born in Pennsylvania, I can't tell you what diseases are screened in Pennsylvania, but I know off that heel stick, that blood spot goes to the state, and then the state performs a number of tests. And as Jim says, it depends, the number of tests depend on the state. And then there's a whole process. If there's a positive test, who gets called at what institution and how the family gets alerted. So it's a complicated process, mm-hmm. but it's something that we're committed to at CHOP. We have a newborn screening program. And in our new Leukodystrophy Center of Excellence, it's one of the four mandates that we have set for ourselves is to have a newborn screening program ready to take care of any children that test positive for Krabbe or these other disorders.
We need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. A number of things I want to add to the conversation as well. And again, that's Amy Waldman. She's a pediatric neurologist. As she mentioned, the medical director of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's Leukodystrophy Center for Excellence. And there is, I guess, a kind of an opening happening tomorrow. Also with us, Maria Kafalas, and she's been telling us about her daughter, Calliope, and she and her husband founded the Calliope Joy Foundation, writing a book about her daughter called Excruciating Joy. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with neurologist Amy Waldman, with sociologist Maria Kafalas. Although we are not here talking about Maria's work, which we have talked about in the past on Radio Times, talking about the work that she and her husband have been doing, an organization, a charity they started in their daughter's name, the Calliope Joy Foundation, serving children with leukodystrophy, supporting pediatric hospice. And we're talking about what it's like to be the parent of a child with a rare disease. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Amy, Jim Kelly, who we talked about at the top of the hour, was talking about a potential treatment available for children with this rare form of leukodystrophy. What is that treatment? What was he referring to?
He's referring specifically to transplant, and there can be cord blood transplants or stem cell transplants, but essentially he's talking about transplant. With children with Krabbe, as Jim mentioned, his son started developing symptoms at 4 months of age. So the community has recognized that you need to do a transplant very early to save children with Krabbe from having the neurologic symptoms. The challenge, though, is that it takes about a year or a year and a half to get enough enzyme to the brain. So you really need to transplant these kids really right at birth to even give them a chance to abate those neurologic symptoms.
But is it work? Is it effective? Is it effective in all cases, some cases? Is it too early to tell?
It's a great question. There's a lot of research done by colleagues throughout the world on this, and I've personally gone to visit them and to talk to them about their research. It's not clear that a transplant in the young age gives us the cure that we were talking about earlier in the show in terms of having a quote-unquote normal child. So it doesn't necessarily, early on in Krebs A, allow that child to walk, talk, go to school. Now, there have been some cases of success, and those are some of the later onset diagnoses of Krebs A. But it may help with some of the symptoms in some of the earlier infantile onset cases.
I was reading actually a medical ethicist, a woman from the University of Chicago, Dr. Lainey Friedman Ross. She said something, my heart goes out to any parent who's going to have a child with this diagnosis. It's a devastating diagnosis, but just because parents are desperate doesn't mean that we should offer them things that actually aren't going to help. I mean, this is what makes this conversation so difficult.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what I have is tremendous hope. Currently in 2015, a standard transplant has been offered to children with Krebs A, but there is research being done throughout the world that have better strategies for transplant, combined transplant with gene therapy, that would allow enough enzyme to get to the brain within a month of the transplant. So I think that newborn screening has been tremendous in moving the medical community forward and very quickly. Now that we're going to be faced with these children in our clinic that have this diagnosis before they start having neurologic symptoms, we need to come up with improved treatment strategies. And this combination of gene therapy transplant is hopeful in some of the other leukodystrophies throughout the world.
I mean, Maria, you're the parent here with a child with one of these devastating disorders. How do you wrestle with that question?
I was in a position where I didn't have to because newborn screening was coming. And we were in a situation where Hannah's Law and Emma's Law had already passed. So I didn't have to. I think there are legitimate challenges. And I think that there are big, big questions here. And I struggle with those questions. But the children were coming. And we built up a relationship with CHOP and Hunter's Hope and said, listen, these kids are coming. Let's help CHOP get ready. And the thing is that there are treatments that are in experimental trials right now in Italy, in particular for my daughter's disease, that do promise what Jim has described. So there are children currently now who have my daughter's disease, who are diagnosed at the same time as my daughter, but the particular cruelty of this disease, the only way that doctors could save them was because an older sibling was diagnosed. So in all these cases, an older child has died, and then a younger sibling was identified pre-symptomatic, and then they were rushed to Italy for this treatment. And these children, whom I have met in some cases, are completely normal.
Wow.
The first child actually speaks two languages. So we're not talking about, oh, they're in a wheelchair, oh, they have some deficits. Or the kids are actually, the children with my daughter's disease, this is one of the most amazing things about this. There are children with my daughter's disease who had a treatment in Italy, which is not approved yet here in the U.S., although it's being supported by GSK, who are getting ready to go to kindergarten. And my daughter's on hospice care. And so that should be probably a pretty horrifying thought to me, but actually it's an incredibly hopeful thought. And when I was in the PICU this winter with Cal, one of the moms sent me a picture of one of the children who had done this treatment. And he was getting his checkup and he was walking and talking. And she was showing me this video of him. And I thought, this is a miracle. And we get to be a part of other people's miracles. And this is something that Liz Scott taught me, that I didn't get to save Alex, but boy, and it's been horrible, but boy, it's pretty awesome to get to help all these other children in her name.
Yeah. I was also reading, Amy, that a number of drug companies are getting more interested in some of these rare diseases and investing more, I guess, research, time, money into coming up with some form of treatment, or at least starting to investigate that.
Absolutely. I think one of the hopes for the future is really breaking down silos. And that we're no longer thinking about these individual diseases, but really thinking about what works in one can work in another. And even though it's a different enzyme, the same gene therapy, the model that we're trying to do, followed by the transplant, if you just alter the enzyme and alter the gene, what can work for one disease can work for the other. So there's tremendous collaboration and tremendous hope.
Does this all come out of the sort of genome project, all the genetic research that's been done, you know, and mapping over the last, couple of decades now?
Yeah, the genetic diagnosis is absolutely the first step, and it's crucial in in working towards cure, and one of the cruelties is that a lot of the children with leukodystrophies, there is no gene yet identified, so they end up in what they call a diagnostic odyssey, where they spend years trying to find the gene so that they can then have these hopeful cures. But yes, genetic is the first step.
Let me get, looks like Janina from Bluebell to join our conversation. Hi, Janina. Go ahead. You're on the air.
It's Anina, but that's okay.
Okay, go ahead.
My daughter, I'm not sure she falls into the rare genetic disorder, but it's one in 12 to 15,000 births. It's called Prader-Willi syndrome, and it's a disease where her hypothalamus never communicates fullness to her brain, so she's hungry all the time. And I could relate to what your speaker was just saying about the sibling, just sort of apologizing to them and saying, so sorry, this kind of stinks for you, but this is just what the way the cards are falling in our family. And so the result, it just makes it difficult because food is everywhere we go. It's at the dry cleaners, it's at the hair salons, it's at the bank and the drive-thru. And it's to the point where, you know, it always creates a discussion and sometimes an argument with her because when she sees food, she wants it. And it's just a very difficult thing to explain to people to please put food out of sight. Like at school, if the teacher has a sharp candy or... Even doctors and dentists' office, you'd be surprised how many of them have food. Is it like a reward? And it's hard to explain to people that it's really a problem for my daughter to have food in her line of sight.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, I mean, there's so many sort of variations on the theme that we've been talking about. Your thoughts, Amy Waldman?
Well, thank you for sharing your personal story about your child. Yes, I think that we're fortunate that we have people at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that are experts in what are considered these rare disorders, including Prader-Willi. And I think what you're talking about really goes to the fact that many of us go about our lives not thinking about how little things affect children like yours or children like Cal. And I think it's a lesson that we all need to appreciate, you know, that we are fortunate and blessed with good health and wish the best for your daughter.
And also sort of helping the rest of us sort of understand the worlds that you live in.
I think it's great that you're out there. And I know believe me, I know how exhausting it is to explain things. And it can be a bit overwhelming, but it's so important to share our children with other people and get them to understand and educate them. So I commend you for that, and I'm there with you.
Yeah, Janina, I appreciate
thank you for your call.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you for your call. And you can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499, talking about an important but sometimes a difficult conversation about how to be a parent, what it's like to be a parent of a child with a rare disease. Going back to you, Maria, and the fact that you have done all this advocacy and had a Facebook page and really put this story out there, do you see what she's doing, and also do you see yourself as part of perhaps a parent-patient advocacy group that can use the internet, they can use crowdsourcing, they can use, you know, that gigantic megaphone to spread the word?
I think some people who are listening might have seen the film Lorenzo's Oil. And actually, Lorenzo had ALD, which is a form of leukodystrophy. And what the film kind of oversimplifies that there was this cure of oil. Unfortunately, that wasn't exactly the case. But Augusto Odon, Lorenzo's father, was, I think, one of the most influential patient advocates that ever was. And, you know, in the film, it's depicted that he traveled around the world and sort of demanded that doctors get out of their silos and work together. And that was actually what he did. And I think that there are people like me who are continuing that and using social media. And the fact of the matter is that whether the pharmaceutical companies or the doctors like it or not, they're kind of stuck with us because the days of them controlling information and giving it to patients when they were ready after it was published is over. I mean, I can use the example of my daughter's disease. The reason I know that these children exist is because of social media, because the families who went to Italy for this treatment were live streaming out of the hospital. Wow. So in the 10 years ago, we would have had to wait for the article. It would be presented. I know more than the GSK executives because the GSK executives are bound under law to have a blind trial. They don't know the name of the children. Yet we know in the community. And so we can put pressure, we can crowdsource. In fact, I think GSK is increasingly, in terms of the role of newborn screening, I predict that our community of families may be part of the fundraising for newborn screening. And as the treatment moves forward, the pharmaceutical companies will call on us to help advocate And it's a strange partnership.
Indeed. Do you like this partnership, Amy?
I do.
I mean, I get that you're really stuck with it, but nonetheless, we want to know how you feel.
I honestly feel that groups like the Calliope Joy Foundation, Hunter's Hope, have really moved science forward. Of course, we're very grateful in medicine to the NIH and other funders, but really, it are family advocacy groups that have advanced science, whether it's the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. I mean, that started with a family member wanting to do something in her sister's name. So all of these family groups have really had a tremendous impact on advancing science and are often able to push science a little bit further with pilot research programs and doing other things and really supporting groundbreaking work in the fields. So
I
don't use
right?
social media, but I think it's been,
you're,
been tremendous.
You're the object of it, I guess, or the subject of it. But is it true in research that, I mean, even if you're focusing on these very rare diseases, which we've been talking about, that there is crossover, that you can learn about something that could be applied to, you know, sore throats or meningitis or some of the more sort of regular everyday conditions?
Absolutely. And that's what we've learned in medicine throughout the years. So many drugs that were designed for one thing have a purpose in another disease. Even in neurology, we use seizure medications for headaches. So there's a lot of crossover in medicine. And really, the Penn Orphan Disease Program was really designed in order to support all of these rare diseases and do that crosstalk in terms of trying to say what works for one and how can we support another disease.
Maria, let me ask you in the couple minutes that we have left about what people should or shouldn't say. And I'm sure, you know, if you're taking Cal around people that look the other way, there are people that might ask questions. I mean, as a parent, and also what you think she wants, how do you suggest people interact? And it's such an awkward question, but
no,
the people
it's a great question.
Uncomfortable. They don't know what to do.
I know, and these diseases are frightening. And I remember being one of those moms who would turn away and think, I don't know how this mom is going to do this or how they do it. Well, first off, never tell us that we're amazing. We hate that. Because the fact of the matter is if you were in the situation, you would do this. We're just doing what we're supposed to do. So when people say God gave you a child or God gave you more, you know, only what you could handle, or, you know, that's not very helpful. And I do think that when wonderful people are around Cal, I think the best and most effective kind of interactions are really when people just realize that she wants to laugh and she likes to be hugged, and she is actually a lot like every other kid. She doesn't talk. She doesn't eat. With her mouth, but she just loves to have a story read to her, and she loves to have people kind of engage with her. And so once you figure out how kids want to be engaged and you realize that there's nothing to be afraid of and that they are just like every other kid in that sense, you'll be just fine.
Yeah, go ahead, Amy.
When I met you, one of the first things I said to Maria was, people are going to say to you, I don't know how you do what you do. And you're going to hate it.
You knew that.
I remember that day.
Yeah, yes. And it's the worst thing to say. I mean, I think that I've actually written down all the great things people said. And one of my favorite things that someone said to me is, Cal is lucky to have you, which is different than saying you're really awesome. I couldn't do what you're doing. When my friend said, Cal's lucky to have you, that was a recognition of that Cal does have things to be fortunate for, you know, and she is blessed and she's amazing. And just like my friend said, she has taught me the meaning of life. I am such a smarter, wiser person. And
are you a better person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, I wish my daughter didn't have to go through this for me to figure it out.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. And Maria Kafalas, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
And she's a professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University, co-founder with her husband of the Philadelphia-based charity. It's called the Calliope Joy Foundation. And she's also writing a memoir about her daughter, Cal. It's called Excruciating Joy. Amy Waldman, thank you very much as well. And she's a pediatric neurologist, the medical director of CHOP's Leukodystrophy Center for Excellence, and newly formed platform program dedicated to the diagnosis and treatment of these rare diseases we've been talking about. And there's a big event tomorrow. Yes?
Yes.
Absolutely. And we began our conversation with former Buffalo Bills Hall of Fame quarterback Jim Kelly. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.